Welcome to this podcast from the Presbyterian Church in Ireland, exploring aspects of our life and witness at this time.
Many of us have favourite places, a beach where the weather is nice, a coffee shop to unwind in, yet our everyday places have become less rooted in their physical reality. The place of work has changed for many through hybrid and work from home culture. The place where we live is often less of a concern because of the ease of travel. And church is a place that many of us drive to, out of one community and into another, passing other churches along the way. Place has changed. Community and communities have changed. It's not surprising that we think less about place. Yet God tells us that we are wherever we are because he has put us there and he has purposes for us there. PCI's present theme invites us and our churches to consider how we are being present where God has placed us to be his witnesses. My name is Johnny McLoone, and I'm the Witness Development Officer for PCI. And I'm joined today by David Thompson, PCI's Secretary for the Council of Congregational Life and Witness, and David Smith, a missiologist. You're both very welcome. I'm looking forward to our conversation today and to hear from you both on how we can be witnesses in our place. David Smith first. David, you spent many years thinking about, writing about, and researching the importance of factoring in the particular local setting of a church as it tries to effectively share the gospel with its neighbours. Could you tell us a little bit more about why a cookie cutter or a one-size-fits-all approach to outreach isn't how things happen in the Bible and doesn't seem to work quite the way we hope it will today? David.
Thank you very much, and thank you for inviting me to be involved in this discussion. It's a real privilege to take part. Yeah, I mean, I think the one thing that above all else has been really significant for me across the years, having ministered first in the city of Cambridge and then gone to Africa and worked in what was effectively tropical rainforest in southeast Nigeria, and found myself asking all kinds of questions, including where actually is mission in this century. And then coming back and encountering what by then was a changed culture. I think if you spend a significant amount of time overseas and return, you have a very keen awareness of the extent to which your own culture has undergone change. So that kind of triggered what has almost been a lifelong quest for an understanding of context and what evangelism, mission, witness means within that change context. And I think there are two dimensions of context. In some ways, this is very obvious, but I think this is what I'd really want to say on this theme. One is obviously the context of the Bible. And I think with all the changes that I've experienced across the years, the growing realization that even when I was ministering in Cambridge for 11 years and involved in an expository teaching ministry, I had not paid sufficient attention to the context of the Bible, including the context of the New Testament. I don't think I perhaps need to blame myself too much for that, because I think the commentaries that I was using now look to me to have overlooked crucial elements of the context of the ministry of Jesus and that of the Apostle Paul. So grappling with that context, recognizing that it was not simply the Jewish tradition that was really important to a proper understanding of the New Testament, but also the impact of the Roman Empire, has become extremely important to me. I think in terms of ministry today, I often hear very fine preaching, which is passionate, urgent, concerned with evangelism. But what is often lacking is a rootage in this context that I'm talking about. The other obvious dimension of context is the context that we're concerned with in this discussion, and that's the world that we face at the present time. And that seems to me increasingly to have many parallels or analogies with the context of the New Testament itself, so that we in a post-Christendom situation are Very close in certain respects. There are significant differences, but we're very close in many respects to the world of Jesus and of the apostles. And that is tremendously important, and I think makes an enormous difference to the way in which we understand the gospel, articulate the gospel, and relate a message of good news and hope to the world that we face in the 21st century. That I think would be the kind of central thrust of what I've wrestled with across the years.
I just love what David said about context there and how, over the course of his life and ministry, he's become more aware of the importance of that. And I think generally in church life, we have got better, Johnny, at recognizing what you were asking about there, that one size doesn't fit all. Although we're still very tied to adopting and adapting approaches and resources, which sometimes are the right responses to the context for witness somewhere else, or they were the right responses at another time. But it does feel to me, like David was saying, to really mature in mission as a church does require us to develop our own expression of Christian practices and responses to where we find ourselves now. And of course, those need to be anchored in and faithful to scripture, but they equally need to address the kind of questions that people are asking today that sometimes bamboozle us a wee bit because they're not what we expect or not where we want to start a conversation. And of course, that won't be the same in Ireland as other parts of the UK or other parts of the world. And it won't be the same across a variety of generations. And it won't be the same in urban communities as rural communities. And in fact, it's going to be different person to person. And that's why all of this feels like hard yards. And we're going to have to learn to listen well and look carefully and be willing to learn and lean into lots of subtle changes in the culture around us and to get on with that and do that before those changes pass us by. And all of that, I think, Johnny, turns on this theme that we're trying to promote through the present initiative, that we need to be attentive to the place where God has put us to be his witnesses. The whole context thing can seem a bit academic and up there, but one of the things I learned a while ago is that the word context comes from the same root as the word weave. And that makes it easier for me because I understand the weave of a basket or the weave of a garment. All of us can kind of get that. A particular weave has its own look and its own feel. So to be effective witnesses where God has placed us as churches or even as individuals in our everyday life is about being present in the weave of community, in the weave of connectedness, in the weave of conversation, and being alive to what happens there and how that happens and who is there and who isn't and what are the assumptions people have about life and about God and about church. So we need to be present right in the middle of all of that to really get the weave. And we won't get it from standing back and looking in and looking on. So much of this is about developing a kind of social spiritual awareness that's very relational, that's very reflective, that's very responsive in real time.
Well, I feel like we've got into the meat of that very, very quickly. Thank you to you both. David Smith, help us unpack this a little bit more. There's an example in the Presbyterian tradition of Thomas Chalmers, who ministered in Glasgow at the time of the explosion in population and poverty as a result of the growth of the city and the Industrial Revolution. And he's wrestled with this idea of context, the changing context. Could you tell us a little bit more about that? And is there something that we can learn from his approach, not necessarily copying it, but from his approach to it?
Well, I think Chalmers was enormously important, not just for Presbyterianism, but for evangelicalism more widely, as an example of someone who, as you said, was absolutely in the midst of the change caused by the Industrial Revolution. So, a Glasgow with a rapidly growing population, with enormous social problems, kind of problems that Engels described in Manchester and all those cities that came out of the Industrial Revolution. And I think, I mean, I'm not an expert on Chalmers, but when I was in Cambridge, I used to frequent a particular second-hand bookshop and found a number of treasures there, one of which was a two-volume set of Chalmers' sermons on Romans. And I remember reading those while I was in Cambridge and thinking, these are really remarkable. This is commentary on Romans like I've not come across elsewhere before. And in those sermons, he's addressing his congregation in the Tron Church, who are not poor and are not disadvantaged. In fact, they are the people who have very much benefited from the Industrial Revolution. And in that context, his messages are really quite remarkable because he clearly listened to their questions, the issues that they are facing, and he finds in the letter to the Romans ways of finding a parallel, a connection, and doing that thing that we talked about earlier of bringing the two worlds, as it were, together. So in that sense, I think he was remarkable. At the same time, he was also profoundly concerned about the growing problem and, in some ways, the threat of extreme poverty among the people who had flooded in from the countryside. And so he develops this scheme, which is a kind of an attempt to maintain the concept of a parish ministry in a rapidly changing world. So what he does, I think, is very relevant to the discussion that we're having here in this context. I have some hesitations about Chalmers. I mean, I think he's undoubtedly a very great man. His legacy still remains very relevant in relation to urban theology. But I'm a bit uneasy about the way in which he very vigorously defended the existing class system in British society. He talks about the monarchy beneath, which is a splendid aristocracy, shelving down to the basement in which the poor find their existence. And that's language that I find uncomfortable, at least today. I'm interested in another Presbyterian who was a contemporary of Chalmers, and ministered not in Glasgow, but in Edinburgh. And you won't be surprised when I tell you that this is Thomas Guthrie, who did something very similar to Chalmers, but in a series of sermons which were published under the title The City, Its Sins and Its Sorrows, takes a very different line in some respects. He's also preaching to a middle-class, prosperous congregation, but he's exposing to them the realities within their city of which they were largely unaware. He had done very significant research. He'd spent time after dark in the streets and alleyways of Edinburgh, and he had compiled a report on the extent of prostitution, of crime, of what was going on in, as it were, the underneath of the city. And those sermons are really remarkable, and they are genuinely prophetic. And he's warning his congregation that unless they can apply the gospel to the realities of an increasingly divided society, socially and economically, then British society faces collapse. So I think this is not pitting one against another, but I think both of these Presbyterians in the 19th century, Chalmers and Guthrie, taken together, provide us with really important and significant examples of men who really wrestled with the reality of the context in which they found themselves. And we have no option but to struggle to do the same.
I love listening to David talking about that because he introduced me to Chalmers and Guthrie when I was a master's student studying on a course that he ran in urban mission a number of years ago. And I kind of came out of the womb as a Presbyterian. So once I heard that these guys were in my tradition, I just loved what he said about them. And actually, the fact that this is a struggle, I think it's really important to acknowledge that. The other thing about context is we can be deeply embedded in our own, a kind of class, middle class context, it makes it very difficult for us to step outside that or see things from a different perspective. And that's true even if we're trying to be really faithful followers of Jesus. But one of the things I loved about this, the more I kind of read Chalmers and Guthrie, was that there's nothing new here in trying to marry faithfulness to scripture with real presence in society as we find it changing around us. And that's deeply embedded in our own theological tradition as Presbyterians, and maybe is something that we really need to retrieve today, and that we certainly shouldn't be scared of trying to find ways of expressing today.
Yeah, thank you. Well, I think that what strikes me, David, is that as you contrasted them both, for one, it was listening to the questions of the people in front, and to the other, it was not just listening to them, but showing them something that they weren't asking, and marrying those together. That's very helpful. Thank you,
Thank you.
David Thompson. The changes across PCI today, what are some of the ways that you're noticing those local settings of context changing in how we connect with communities for outreach and evangelism?
I think this is just massive for us today. We've gone from a time when the local church was known and respected in the local community, where we opened up our doors and people just came or sent their kids or associated with us in some level in their spiritual life, to a time when we can be almost invisible to those around us. We think we've got this massive big building that everybody sees when they walk past or they drive past. But actually, even though it's massive in the landscape or the streetscape, we can be almost invisible to people around us. So I think what I'm picking up is that it feels like organizations and activities for children still have some connectivity in local communities with people who don't go to our church. But it's definitely getting harder to retain that with teenagers, particularly post-COVID. In the inner city and the outer estate context, that old traditional working class community that was almost deferential to the church has largely gone now. And in some cases, it's really good to see that that's been replaced by growth in newcomers from other countries. And some of our churches have found ways to connect with them really, really well. And that's one of the really encouraging things about what's happening in the inner city and those outer estates. In the countryside, where church connection and church going remain strongest for longest, I think that's sliding. That's definitely sliding, particularly among younger generations. And PCI is probably strongest now in the suburbs and the commuter type areas that still seem to retain some kind of connectedness with us. I mean, through largely having the same kind of middle class values as we often have, for good or for ill. But equally, the challenge of that is that that segment of society can be the most secular in their views and the most insulated from engaging in any kind of community by the routines and the rhythms by which they live their life. So I think, Johnny, nobody has it easy connecting these days. Nobody has it easy. It's something we just have to work at and experiment with, and we certainly can't take it for granted that people have church on their radar at all. And maybe the difference these days is that it's about finding lots of little ways of making our positive presence felt locally among all sorts of different groups and generations of people, rather than that highly demanding kind of all year round programming that we've been used to running and are finding increasingly hard to sustain anyway. So, however it works for us in our setting, we need to find ways of being present for others that are real, that are relational, that connect, that create opportunities to show and share and speak about the love of Jesus. And some of the old ones still have traction, but I think we're needing to get used to carefully identifying and implementing some new ways of doing things. And on the back of those connections, we do need to find and take confidence to share what we actually believe as Christians. How, even if it can be a hard thing for contemporary society to hear, God's message of sin and salvation really can be good news for all kinds of people, and that it really can transform communities one life at a time.
David, you mentioned this sort of like communities and the local setting and this church in the landscape. Is this idea of parish, is it still meaningful in a very mobile and increasingly online culture?
Yeah, that's a great question, and one that's being talked about in all sorts of parts of the church across the UK and in other settings as well. And I think parish is still meaningful, but in varying degrees depending on your location. So where people are less mobile, Johnny, and they don't have easy access to their own car, they still live largely local lives. Their schooling and their shopping and their socializing and their sport can all take place in the same area that's within the walking distance of the church. So that's probably true in a lot of inner city and urban areas where people are less mobile. The more people are mobile, though, the more they're likely to live their lives in a much wider web of relational networks so that their postcode becomes almost irrelevant. And when we map onto that, how much our lives are lived online these days, that makes proactive contact with a local church by those who don't belong increasingly less likely. So it feels to me like some churches need to think very intentionally local, and the parish serves as a really helpful boundary for what they're trying to do and who they're trying to reach in their outreach and evangelism. But other churches need to find ways of inhabiting these wider networks that form around these shared interest groups. And to them, neighbourhood or parish will seem less important than networks and groups of people. And they're pushing into this greater openness in the way we live and the way we form community these days that isn't always organised around physical boundaries we can draw on a map. Now, I've kind of painted two pictures there, but to be honest, everybody, every church probably has a bit of neighbourhood and a bit of network going on at the same time. And maybe the most important thing is not to be vague and not to be woolly about where the balance falls and where and how we're trying to connect in outreach and evangelism. Because where we allow ourselves to fall into that trap, it's usually a sign that we're aiming at nothing and we're probably going to hit it. I suppose one other thing to acknowledge is that with the current reconfiguration of congregations that's going on across our denomination, we aren't going to have as many buildings in as many places in future. And so our idea of parish and our idea of being locally present is going to have to broaden and change. But I think positively, as churches find ways to work together over a broader geographical area, outreach and evangelism may become more effective rather than less effective. But ultimately, however it pans out, it'll still be about finding ways to be present where God has placed us to be as witnesses that just might not always involve a church building and a set of halls the way we tend to think about it.
David, could you tell us a little bit about the rural region of Galilee and what they were all and the significant changes they were already experiencing in the day whenever Jesus was ministering there? And are there parallels that we could draw with from that as to how rural areas could be experiencing change today?
It's a very good question, and it connects directly with what I said at the beginning about context, because I think this is the crucial area of context that has been really important in my discoveries, especially over the last, I guess, 10 years or so. There's been a lot of work exploring the impact of empire on Palestine in general, but in particular on the Galilee, because wherever the Romans established their power, one of the means of cementing that power and at the same time enforcing their worldview was in the building of cities. So that a civilizing mission was also an urbanizing mission. And everywhere across the Roman world, cities appeared in a particular form that was not neutral, that carried the message that Rome was eternal, that history was coming to an end, and nothing could be hoped for beyond Roman dominance. And I think the realization that this is the context of the ministry of Jesus himself has made an enormous difference to my reading of the gospel. The two cities that are significant here are obviously Tiberias, which is built during the lifetime of Jesus as a new capital on the shores of the Lake of Galilee, embedding a Roman vision and Roman ideology and seeking to link the Galilee with the Roman Empire more generally. And then the town of Sepphoris, which is not mentioned in the New Testament, but was within sight of the village of Nazareth. And it was the location of one of many acts of rebellion against Roman dominance, which resulted in the total destruction of the city. And then it was rebuilt once again on a Roman model. Now, you have all of this happening within sight of Nazareth. When the Romans destroyed the city of Sepphoris, they crucified hundreds of young men who had not been in the city, but in adjacent villages, who were suspected of being sympathetic with insurrection. Now, just think of Mary's Magnificat in that context, and realizing the enormous influence of these cities designed to embed Roman power and authority enables one to hear the language of Jesus himself in a very different way. And I've become very concerned, as you might know, with the issue of mammon and Jesus' demand that we choose between God or mammon. And that comes out of this context, these changes that are taking place in Palestinian villages, and the distress and the anguish, which is reflected again and again in the gospel accounts, and then link that with the world in which we are living, in which mammon is becoming completely dominant on a global scale. And seems to me to be the one great challenge that world Christianity faces in the 21st century. So, in that sense, the context of the New Testament has become enormously important.
Yeah, that's so fascinating, isn't it? Because our image of rural life in the Bible doesn't generally equate to what David's just described. And often, as we think about mission and evangelism and outreach in rural areas and from rural churches, we kind of imagine that those areas are stable and unchanging, and they're absolutely not. They're also experiencing rapid change today. And we sometimes have in our heads this idea that they also escape the kind of impact of secularism on our lives and on our society and the way we think and the way we live and what that does on our hearts. But actually, that's not the case either. And so we just need to be more aware, don't we, that there's a particular form of rural mission as much as there's a particular form of urban mission, which we talk about quite a lot, and it's become kind of where it's at in many people's heads. And we really need to think if we're going to be the Presbyterian Church in all of Ireland, then we need to find ways to genuinely express our mission in those rural contexts today as well, with all of that in our head from the Bible and also in our present context. That just seems so important.
David Thompson, we've talked a little bit around cities. We talked a wee bit about rural spaces. Help us think a little bit about life in the suburbs, maybe places that are growing commuter towns around our cities where people do little more than live and sleep there. Because whenever we're thinking about outreach and evangelism, we often think it rests on building good relationships, long-term relationships. But in those sorts of places, community can be hard to find. So, what are the particular challenges and opportunities in those places for churches to reach out to their neighbours?
Yeah, as much as I said earlier on that PCI is probably strongest in the very areas that you've described, we definitely need to make sure that we still have a mission ledge in those communities and we're not just thinking about our members and thinking about what suits us and what sort of lives and what sort of church life we can construct for ourselves. And the whole concept of suburban living is really about having your own sectioned off space to live where you can feel safe and secluded from everybody else. And the very built environment in the suburbs is about enjoying distance from your neighbour and having high hedges around your garden, and having the kind of garage connected to your house where you can drive your car in and you don't have to speak to anybody else. And people who live in the suburbs will kind of recognise some of that. Your home can be little more than a place to sleep, and the rest of life can take place elsewhere, and it all depends on having a car. And so that's tricky for churches to inhabit that place, isn't it? And yet people are built for community. And it may be that the church has a crucial function to play in the suburbs as being an almost unique place where people can meet in the suburban space. And that might be especially the case where the population of a suburb has aged because the children have grown up and moved away and the parents are left behind and they're now retired with a bit more time in their hands, but maybe not a lot of company. And some congregations have found really simple ways to open their doors and connect to that demographic of people and to share faith with those in later life. And remember, it's that demographic that is ever increasing in terms of the percentage of the total population in both Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. So we will need to be particularly alert and alive to the possibilities of outreach and evangelism to them. I'm not sure anybody's got this really figured out yet, and we're all trying to find our way, but there's something really important to grapple with here. Johnny, let me ask you, in the past you trained as an architect, and so the built environment is something you understand, and that is really changing these days. How do you think that's impacting on communities? And as a knock-on effect of that, how do churches need to take another look at the place they occupy, and what it's like around their district?
Yeah, well, that was quite a while ago and never quite crossed the line with it. But I think one of the things that's apparent to me is that the built environment is less influential than it used to be on how we form communities, or at least it certainly appears so. Like David, you mentioned earlier on about our increasing mobility and our digital connectivity. And those two things are they're major factors now within the culture of the communities that we're part of and that we form. And previously, communities were probably influenced largely by those physical environments they were part of. And David Smith, you mentioned this about the Romans and how they built, and that you sort of said that they didn't build neutrally; they built with an intention as to how they were, what they were trying to create. And that was true of our built environment that we still see around us. Planners and architects considered how we should or how we could live lives individually and collectively. They gave us access to shared spaces and thought about new ways that we could live together. And I think the built environment can still have a big influence on how we live. And maybe formerly it was considered a noble pursuit whenever you were building to consider how people would interact and how do you create culture, create community. And maybe that's not as appreciated as it once was, or maybe it's not as socially valuable whenever it's an increasingly individualistic and materialistic world. Or maybe it's not as achievable in the money talks environment where we need more houses and we're trying to do it in a cost-effective way. But our churches were built at a different time. They were built whenever culture around them and community was different, but also it has changed for them. So churches that used to be built outside of the town may have found in that urban sprawl or the disappearing of green belts or the need for more housing that there are now homes all around them that they didn't used to have. Some churches will have seen the social and economic demographic of their community change within living lifetime. And some churches will have seen the businesses that operate change completely or maybe even just disappear for the lack of people to use them. But wherever we are, whether it's city centre, urban, suburban, or rural, the built environment or lack of it communicates the type of community that we're in. And that social physical space that the church is in, it is changing. It's always changing because the culture is always changing. There's always buildings popping up and there's always buildings changing and how they're being used. And I think we will have an impression as to what we think our buildings are doing in the community that they're part of. But equally, people who are part of our local community will have an impression too. David, you mentioned that what they think about whenever they drive past and maybe our impressions, because it could be seen that the church is a relic of the past. It could be seen as a monument against progress. It could be seen maybe as an integral part of the community or a place that serves those that are in need. We probably hope that it's seen as a valued place in the community and adding value. We don't want to be obscure or seen as an insular place. We want to be a joyful, attractive, welcoming community. But the question then is, how do we be seen as that? I think, as you mentioned, churches need to look and reflect on the community that they're part of, because as they do that, undoubtedly it'll inform the way that they serve and interact and witness into that community.
I wonder if it's worth just mentioning here. There's a project in Dublin that you might be aware of called the Third Space. It's a cafe which is close to the law courts. It's a Christian project, but it's deliberately ambiguous in providing not a secular space or a religious space, but a third space where conversation can take place. And it's been remarkably successful in providing a place where conversations can happen between people who don't have faith but are asking questions. And maybe that concept, that idea, this has a bearing on what we're talking about in terms of the use of church buildings. Maybe in the culture in which we find ourselves, this idea of a third space, a kind of intermediate space, could be quite significant for the future.
So, Johnny, back to you. These whopping big church buildings that we have, how can we use the asset that that is, which is enormous, handed down to us, the inheritance that it is, that maybe sometimes feels a bit like a millstone round our neck because we have to maintain it. How can we maximize the opportunity of our buildings for local connection and outreach? What do you think?
Yeah, I think, David, maybe to say first that the way that we design and build is influenced by the function that we have in mind for the spaces and how we want to do community and life. And maybe the way that's most recognizable for us is in our homes, because there's been a bit of a cultural shift to these more informal and flexible spaces. It's led to many people changing their homes to have this multi-space of a kitchen, living, dining, because it facilitates more family interactions, it facilitates more socializing in one cohesive space. And I think what we see is that that's changed culture, and our churches were designed at a time there's different concerns and different ideals. They reflected a certain style and a certain aspiration as to this is what churches should look like, with towers and stained glass and high ceilings, and outside you could very much see the spaces that were inside as well. And internally, the design requirements were arguably quite minimal, certainly in Protestant churches, where the centrality of preaching led to long halls and a raised speaking platform, and even these wraparound galleries to accommodate more people that could see and hear the preacher. But the culture has shifted, and values have evolved. And formerly, whenever we built a lot of our churches, the desire for grandeur, for communicating solidity, secureness, firmness, permanence, and setting something apart and embellishing it. Unfortunately, some of those same intentions and the design, the outworkings of those designs, those used to be form positive values, but they can now come across as cold or distant, impersonable, and maybe even give the impression of a holier than thou impression to the people around. And that's not what would we want, and it wasn't what was intended. But it's because the culture has changed around us, and I think we should see our buildings, as you said, as entrusted to us to steward for God's purposes. The purposes have remained, but the methods that we have are now doing church and mission have changed, and we are trying to contextualize them, as David's mentioned, to the culture. Many of the churches that we've got, the design of the past doesn't facilitate the way that we want to do worship. We struggle with where do we put the screen and the projector, where do we put the musicians, how do we amplify them, how will they be heard, how can everybody see the children's address. And in the same way that we've adapted the spaces for those practices of worship, we need to consider how our buildings can be amazing assets in that we can use to help people find and follow Jesus. Because the built environment intuitively speaks to us. We know whenever we've walked into a school, we know when we've walked into a medical environment, we know even whenever we've walked into something that feels like a waiting room. So what are we doing with our churches? What are we communicating to people as they drive or as they walk past? What are the values that they see from us? What do they feel whenever they come inside for a funeral, a wedding, to drop their kids off? Maybe they've come in to be part of a uniformed service or even for a recreational activity like Pilates or bowls. There's a real opportunity for our buildings to say something about who we are, what we believe, what happens in this building, and actually what we want to invite everyone to be part of. Some of our churches have done renovations and they're amazing. They've adapted spaces to welcome people, to create more spaces for community. But not every church can do that. But actually, there's a challenge in the first chapter of the book of Haggai that resonates with me, that I think the challenge is that we can invest in our own homes and our own lives at the expense of God's house. And it doesn't have to be a building project, but we can still invest in God's house and thinking about how people who come in will experience it, thinking about what they will see and what they will feel. Have we made it easy for them to use our building? We want to make them feel welcome. Do we want to communicate who we are? And I think maybe it's helpful, David, there's three things that I think we need to create spaces for in our church. Somewhere that the community can just come and feel like this is part of us, is part of who we are. Somewhere they can just come and be together. But also we want to create spaces where people can come and see what the Christian faith and worldview is all about. See the community in action and experience the blessing of a people of faith who love them. And ultimately, to come to a space where they can hear Jesus' invitation to come and follow me, to see and figure out what it means to live that out. I think our churches have a bit of a somewhat untapped potential to communicate the right to full experience of a relationship with Jesus can offer. David Smith, maybe last word to you on this whole area of church and local impact in a changing world.
I thought I would conclude with a personal story. There's a lot of discussion about Generation Z, the latest generation to become wage earners, and facing such a different world. The impact of AI and the immense changes that are taking place, creating what one sociologist has called a liquid world. What he calls solid modernity has been replaced by a liquid world in which nothing remains really secure or lasting. I was in a Vodafone office in Glasgow a couple of weeks ago trying to get some advice on my phone, and I was pointed to a girl working in that office to help me, and she was Generation Z. And in the course of the discussion, she asked me to repeat my email address. So I began to spell it out, DW ANDJM, and she said, "Stop there just a minute. Do you mean to tell me you have the same address as her?" So I said, "Well, yes, I did. She actually died 10 years ago, but I don't want to change the address." And she said then, "You are so lucky. You have been so lucky to have been born when you were born. Because I can't imagine in my generation that relationship can any longer be possible." And that really drove home to me the reality of the context that we're facing. But it also gave me hope. In the last years of the Soviet Union, there was a very significant movement among young people who had become completely disillusioned with a thoroughly secular worldview. Many of them were quite intelligent. There's one woman in particular who was a philosophy student, and she turned to the Orthodox Church and had a really dramatic experience of conversion and of finding God, and founded a seminar in what was then Leningrad with other young people of that generation who were similarly coming to faith. And it leaves me to wonder whether we might be on the verge of seeing something very significant like that happening in Western culture. So our discussion is very, very relevant, I think, and very helpful and encouraging. And I think we can wrestle with these issues, not out of despair, but with genuine hope that in God's mercy and grace, we might see a new era of great fruitfulness if we really listen to the Spirit and follow the Spirit's leading as we approach our particular context.
Thank you, David, and thanks, David Thompson, too, for a fascinating conversation. And thanks to you for listening, and we hope that this has been stimulating for you as you consider where God has placed you and your church to be his witnesses. Keep an eye out for future podcasts, but why not check out the Present Initiative webpage on the PCI website for more content to help you think about these things.
You've been listening to a podcast from the Presbyterian Church in Ireland. Thanks for joining us.